how do you know that somebody privileges making a certain amount of money every year, a little bit more than they made the previous year, or having slightly more generous Social Security benefits? How do you know that they prioritize that over abortion or over gun control or over whatever other issue that they care about? So it's kind of condescending to come in and say you're voting against your personal interests, because that's telling people what their interests are when they think they do a pretty good job determining what those interests are themselves.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and a podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest today somebody I think you're going to find very interesting, who heads up a think tank, I think you could call it, that focuses on working class politics. In fact, it's called the Center for Working Class Politics, and the director is Jared Abbott, who's a fellow Midwesterner, Indiana, and he's going to talk with us a little today about what the center does and some of its important research recently. Jared, thank you so much for being on today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You know, again, for our listeners, working class is the definition of a lot of our region here. The accepted definition are those without college degrees. We kind of go off of working class districts being those districts with a higher number of people without degrees than the national average. And most of our counties out here feature that. And most of our counties out here also on both sides of the river are those Obama-Trump counties everybody likes to kind of look at in amazement, especially those who aren't as familiar with politics. But Jared, let's get into all this today. I think it's going to be very interesting. But first of all, talk a little bit about Center's mission and when it got started, and maybe a little bit about your background.
Oh, sure. The Center got started in 2021 as an effort by different political scientists and people involved in campaigns to try to understand how Democrats can do a better job of reaching working class voters, right? And we had at that time, you know, a very small group, but now we've grown and we have a collective. In other words, just people who do different kinds of research for us of 20 or so people. And we do survey research, we do focus groups, we do interview projects of different kinds. Our mission is essentially to try to show Democrats and progressives that working class people don't see the world in the way in which many of them do. And that if we don't do a much better job of trying to understand and see and take seriously and respect the way that working people see the world, then the huge drift of working people toward the Republican Party and away from the Democrats, who were once viewed as the party of the working class by working people, but have not been so since the 1990s, you know, it's just going to keep moving in the same direction. And so that's kind of our mission, is to try to be, to some degree, the working class whisperers to the, you know, the progressive, you know, well-meaning progressives who don't really have a clue about, you know, what working people care about, think about, or how to reach them.
And so you, what's your background a little bit from Indiana? Tell us a little bit about how you wound up in this position.
Oh, yeah. My family's from a small rural town in Indiana, in eastern Indiana. You know, it's 75-80% Trump, you know, in every election. And all my family, you know, there's a few Democrats, you know, but not that many. And, you know, it just comes second nature to me to sort of like not think that people who voted for Trump are crazy, like, you know, the people on the coast think, or that they're terrible racists or whatever. No, they're just normal people that, you know, see the world differently. And, you know, they come from a perspective in many cases of being extremely disillusioned by promises made but not kept by the Democratic Party over a number of decades. And And it's not hard for me to understand, you know, why somebody would take their anger at the Democrats and turn it to an outsider who's promising them things that, you know, they feel reflect how they actually feel, right? In terms of both bringing back manufacturing jobs and trying to, you know, regain America's sort of golden age of manufacturing prestige in the post-war era. And on the other hand, just the vitriol and anger that he feels toward elites. Like, this is something that is very organic and visceral to most working people. But it's something that, you know, many elites, liberals, progressives view as, you know, just beyond the pale, or how could you ever, you know, support something like that? But coming from where I do with the family and my background, it's, you know, just like you, I'm sure, Robin, this is not something that's hard to understand.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I hear this quite often from some of my friends, those in academia especially, very frustrated that working class people aren't voting their interests. The Thomas Frank theory from What's the Matter with Kansas. What are they voting their interests? Would they vote for Republicans or Trump? I mean, I'll just put it to you. I've got my views, but
I mean, the thing about it is, if you want to have an objective definition of what their material interests are, and you want to compare whether or not they're voting for somebody who's going to represent those, okay, you could do that. And, you know, and if you said that is my material interests are a president that's going to increase my standard of living in terms of how much income I have or how much you know, social safety net benefits I'm receiving, or whatever you want to do, you know, then you could reasonably argue that people are voting against their economic self-interest, at least some people are, because Trump, like the Trump tax credits, for instance, you know, certainly hurt working people. And they definitely helped the most wealthy people in the country. And, you know, the cuts that they've made toward SNAP and federal benefits like that hurt poor and working people, obviously. So there is a sense in which that's not entirely wrong if you vote for somebody who implements things that are clearly harmful to working people, which Trump has in fact done. But it's not like there's not another side of the coin, right? Which is that, you know, Trump is the first person, you know, he doesn't do this as much as he used to, but especially in 2016, you know, he was talking about the problems of deindustrialization and the problems of lost manufacturing jobs in a way that Democrats just never did, because they were stuck in this bubble of, you know, globalization is going to bring great benefits to everybody. And if it's not happening to you, don't worry about it. We'll get to you. You know, that was sort of the vibe for a long time. And Trump came on and said, this is BS. And, you know, I care about you folks who've been left behind by globalization, offshoring, outsourcing, all these different things that have hollowed out communities in the Rust Belt and across the country that, you know, used to have thriving main streets and now have boarded up windows, et cetera. I can totally understand why somebody would think that this person is going to be in their self-interest. And plus, Trump, number one, I mean, the economy was doing pretty well under the first Trump administration. So it's not crazy for somebody to think that if he's brought back in 2025, you know, Biden's period was a period of high inflation, and the Democratic Party essentially gaslit people for about a year, acting like they were too dumb not to understand that the economy was doing really well. And by the time they started acknowledging that, you know, there really was a problem and started talking about inflation and affordability, people just didn't believe him anymore. And so it's completely understandable that somebody would look at Trump in 2025 and say, oh, yeah, that person's probably going to do a better job for me on the economy. Is there another side? Yes, I gave the other side. So you could see it sort of either way, but I don't think it's irrational. And the other part of this is, you know, people, like you say, oh, people vote on social issues rather than economic issues, right? Okay, maybe they value those things more than they value economic issues, right? Like, that's the problem with the Thomas Frank argument. It's like, how do you know that somebody privileges making a certain amount of money every year a little bit more than they made the previous year, or having slightly more generous Social Security benefits? How do you know that they prioritize that over abortion or over gun control or over whatever other issue that they care about? So it's kind of condescending to come in and say you're voting against your personal interests, because that's telling people what their interests are when they think they do a pretty good job determining what those interests are themselves.
I'm curious what you think, Jared. You mentioned earlier this started in the 1990s, and for a lot of people I talk to anyway, think these are frustrated Democrats that this all started with Trump, this realignment, and it really didn't. It started before then, although he certainly accelerated it. But what were the things that happened back in the 90s when it began, you started to see this realignment where, again, for our listeners, Democrats, traditionally a strong base of the New Deal coalition from FDR forward, started moving over to the Republicans?
Yeah, that's a great point, Robin. I mean, the floodgates really do fly open in 2016 in terms of this movement of working class people away from the Democratic Party. And I think a lot of the reason why that happened was because there was a lot of pent up feeling of anger about the way that the Democratic Party had treated working class people. But there was no engine, there was no catalyst for really expressing that. And Trump kind of brought that out into the open. And I think that's why you see the floodgates open. But absolutely, what's happening in the 90s is trade policy. And I mean, among other things, we can talk about the drift of, major, elite institutions becoming more liberal over time, becoming more out of touch with working class values. That's a part of the story, too. Cultural elitism is a big problem for the Democratic Party. But on the economic side, you know, Bill Clinton came into office and he promptly became the cheerleader for a NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is now the USMCA. And basically, this had been a Republican policy that had been pushed forward by George H.W. Bush. And Clinton just said, we're going to do it. And they basically said, OK, this is going to cost a few jobs. We're going to open up trade between Mexico and Canada and the United States. It's going to bring in a lot more investment to the United States. It's going to create all kinds of new jobs. And will there be some people that are laid off, you know, in the process? OK, yeah, but we're going to have job retraining programs for them. We're going to have all kinds of ways to get them into new and better jobs. And then even for those that are struggling, we're going to compensate them by, you know, expanding benefits, unemployment benefits, or, you know, go to college or whatever. And what happened? Well, that's not what happened. Like, pretty immediately, many, many places that had factories, especially in like the upper South and in places that had textile, the textile industry was the one that got hit the hardest by NAFTA because most of those jobs went to Mexico. The people in counties that got hit by NAFTA, what's often called the NAFTA shock, where the mills and the factories that had been there for decades, they just shut down pretty promptly in the mid to late 90s, and they moved to Mexico or to elsewhere in the South. And you see, economists have looked at this question in great detail. There's some fabulous work done on it. And they show very clearly that the higher the exposure a county had to NAFTA, in other words, the higher number of jobs or factory closings, job layoffs or factory closings that a county experienced in the mid to late 90s, the larger the shift away from the Democratic Party in those counties during this time period. So there's basically almost a one-to-one correlation. It's not that high, but it's a very strong correlation between counties that are affected by Democratic trade policies and through job loss. And then what happens after job loss? Community disinvestment. What happens after that? Opioid addiction, right? And then there's a downward spiral in communities across the country, and you lose the social fabric, and then people feel a sense of hopelessness. And then what do they have? They get, the McDonald's comes to town and they can get a job there, right? With a much lower wage and with a much less sense of dignity at work than they would have had before. And people feel like their lives have been destroyed by this policy that the Democrats implemented. And to add insult to injury, what did the Democrats do in 1999? Oh, they spearheaded China's entrance into the World Trade Organization, right? Which meant that even more jobs were going to be affected by Democratic-led trade policies, which allowed for much greater job loss to China through sort of lower labor costs. And so many other communities were affected by what's called the China shock. And the same process ensues where counties that are affected, there's people that have done great research on this too, counties that were disproportionately affected by job layoffs or mass layoffs by the China shock, you know, were counties that became increasingly Republican during this time period too. So to me, that's the kind of core story, is that basically the Democrats sold out, you know, even though, yes, if I were, I still would have voted for Democrats relative to Republicans during this time period, because, okay, they were still more in favor of like things that I like more spending on education, like more generous unemployment benefits and things like that. But still, if I had been somebody that lost my job and thought that the Democrats were on my side, or if I had been people in communities that were, you know, devastated by these Democratic cheer-led and designed policies, you know, I would be pissed off. And since we live in a country that has only two major parties, you kind of only have one choice, right? If you don't like the Democrats, you're going to go to the Republicans. And that's what more and more working class people did. At the same time, you see increasingly the higher educated, the higher income folks in the electorate who used to be overwhelmingly Republican in the 80s and 90s, but then decreasingly so in the 90s and 2000s. By the time Trump comes to office, you see a complete flip, so that the Democratic Party is primarily made up, or that they're disproportionately made up of people with advanced or at least a college, 4-year college degree, a relatively high income. And the Republican Party is the party that's primarily made up of, you know, people without a 4-year college degree and lower income. And the upshot of all this is the Democratic Party plays more and more into the interests and the preferences of more well-to-do voters who are, you know, cultural elites, you might say, of some kind, not elite in the sense that they're better, but elite in the sense that like they are in, you know, they control, you know, media institutions, and they're more likely to be college professors or lawyers or doctors or things like that. And so the party becomes more and more out of touch with working people, because the base of the party becomes more and more detached from working people, such that by 2016, somebody like Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, is willing to say, we just don't need those working class people anymore. And he had this infamous quote where he said that, you know, for every one of those, you know, blue collar rednecks out in Western PA that we lose, we're going to get three, you know, well-to-do, you know, Philly professionals that are going to make up the difference. And you know what? He was wrong. And that's, I think, one of the principal reasons that we're in this mess right now.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is Jared Abbott, who's the director of the Center for Working Class Politics. He's talked a little bit about the center's mission and some of its work. We've talked, engaged a little bit, discussion about the great realignment of working class voters from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. I don't know about you out there listening, but I think this is fascinating, because this is topic A, I think, for our region. These types of voters are more prevalent out here. Especially the role of trade in this realignment. And just for our listeners, to give you an idea, there are more working class voters as defined by college degrees than those with college degrees. It's about 65%, 35%, somewhere right in there.
Well, way more in Iowa.
Yeah. I mean, that's nationwide. You're absolutely right. Now, Illinois, the college degree percentage is a little higher than the national average. Your center's written about this. The Democratic brand is absolutely toxic, especially, I live in a rural county, especially in rural counties. And two states, magnify this. One is Nebraska, where in the last cycle, Dan Osborne ran as an independent. I had him on my show. He ran, I think, 8 to 10 points higher than the other U.S. Senate candidate and Kamala Harris, but he ran as an independent. Most of his policies were Democratic leaning. Some were more Republican leaning. The other state is Missouri. I just had on my show the 2-term governor of Missouri, Jay Nixon, you know, this state has statewide referenda. Voters have voted to expand Medicaid. enact abortion rights against right to work, raise a minimum wage and legal pot. But yet, if a Democrat runs with those positions, they usually run 8 points lower, 8 to 10 points lower than these get. What can the Democrats do, if anything, and most rural voters are working class by definition. What are they going to do to overcome this toxic demand?
Well, yeah, that's a huge question. And we did a survey recently in just four Rust Belt states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And we basically tried to like get exactly at what is what we call the Democratic penalty. And we basically had two versions of candidates that we showed to people taking the survey, and they were identical. They had a great economic populist platform that, you know, many of your listeners would probably think was, right up their alley. But one of them we said was an independent, and one of them we said was a Democrat. And the exact same candidates who should be doing really, really well, the Democrat on average got 8% less support than the same candidate who was an independent. And in certain states like Ohio, it was 15 points more. And so right there, you see why Sherrod Brown lost his last Senate election in Ohio, right? Which is because he's one of the greatest champions of economic populism, you know, that the Senate's had in recent memory. And he couldn't overcome the Democratic, the negative coattails of the Democratic Party. So what can they do about this? Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, I think the one thing is build, and the Democratic Party wouldn't be doing this, but I think that people that are interested in beating Republicans in places like Iowa, where we have a couple of interesting Democratic candidates for the Senate race there, particularly Nathan Sage, who I think is really interesting. But bracketing that, we need to have more Dan Osbornes. And this guy, you said he overperformed. He overperformed every other Senate candidate on the Democratic side, which is, you know, he still lost because he was in Nebraska. So the advantage that he had to overcome was so extreme. But he's running again, and I think he's got a really good shot. But what we think is that you could do the Dan Osborne model in deep red places in many more contexts. And so we're actually doing work now we're doing a survey that will come out in a few months, where we're only looking at people and talking with people who are in, you know, Trump or R plus 20 districts, like, right? Places where there's no, what we call the spoiler effect. There's no problem of like a third party coming in and, you know, maybe like taking the election away from the Democrats, because the Democrats never going to run a competitive election anyway. And so we think that, and that's like statewide in Nebraska, that would be an example of something like that. They haven't had a competitive Democrat, you know, since the mid 2000s or something along those, was it Ben Nelson maybe? We think that there are many places, many, you know, individual congressional districts in many states where you could do a Dan Osborne. And we're doing a survey to try to get at whether or not this is actually plausible. And if we could just have more places where the thing that Democrats could do is not have a primary and just sit it out and just open the field up to the independent candidates. How long is that going to work? I mean, that's hard to say, right? Because people are not stupid, and they're going to see that, well, this guy is kind of actually is like the Democrat because the Democrats are in some way coordinating with them. And, you know, so that is a problem. And so we don't know how long that independent label can hold up. Dan Osborne will help us see that a little bit more this cycle. But, you know, I think there's a lot of room for, it's not that Dan Osborne was having more Democratic policies, I would say. It's that he was having more populist, economic, progressive economic policies. And, you know, and he was with Trump on the border wall, right? I mean, he was, you know, this guy had, he understood, he listened to his constituents. He said, I'm not going to try to run in a place that's full of people who love President Trump and talk about, you know, how I hate all of President Trump's policies. Like any independent in a place like that, you know, he's going to have to listen to and be responsive to the people that he's voting for, or that are voting for him. But at the same time, he was pushing the envelope forward on the things that every working family shares in common, which is a need for a better standard of living, which is a need for reining in the power of corporations and the need for putting power in the hands of working class people. And so I think that's the number one thing that Democrats, well, one of the number one things they can do is allow for more independents to run on economic populist campaigns and see if we can get into deep red territory as independents, as economic populists who have some policies on social issues that might seem more Republican, some that might seem more Democrat, but focused on economic populism and see if we can make inroads. And I think that we can. And but what else can the Democratic Party do? They can run more candidates that, you know, have an economic populist message and focus. And they're even we're doing an analysis now of all the 2024 candidates. And a surprise, well, I don't know if it's surprising or not, but a pretty small percentage of Democratic congressional candidates really center economic populism or even bread and butter issues in their campaigns, but especially a kind of we need to say to hell with corporate elites that have sold us, you know, a bill of goods for decades, and to hell with the Democratic establishment that's been, you know, making promises over and over again to working class people and not following through. And Democrats need Democrats that want to win in these sorts of places where working class people are very skeptical of Democrats. That's the path forward. And you can look at people like, you know, for there are other complicating issues with some of these candidates, but think about somebody like Jared Golden, you know, in Maine, who he's not running for re-election. He's had some issues, but for a long time, the guy was running way ahead of other Democratic candidates. And one of the main things that he did, whatever else you think about his policies, which, you know, is we could talk about, but one of the things that he did was he very much ran against the Democratic Party as a Democrat, right? Just like Joe Manchin would have done. That's another thing that, like, these are the sorts of people that, even if you don't agree with all their policy positions, this is the kind of thing that they need to do if they want to try to deal with the Democratic penalty, is to send strong signals and maybe even costly signals that puts them into real fights with Democratic leaders that they are not Democratic establishment candidates, that there's something else, and that they're going to push back against the Democratic Party when they, you know, threaten to, you know, compromise on supporting working people. So those are a couple of things that I would throw out there.
All right, I got 2 minutes. One's a longer question, but you're going to have to truncate it. And sure, one's a really short one. You're okay. No. Under Clinton, the message was, it's the economy, stupid. And there's a lot of people that say, oh, well, all the Democrats have to do is just have a populist economic message. There are some like Rui Teixeira who say that's not good enough. These cultural issues are going to drag Democrats down no matter where they are. The defund the police, trans rights. In like a minute, what do you think? I know that's unfair to limit. Yeah,
no, first, I think that to some degree that the jury's still out. The one thing that we know is that no Democrats in competitive districts and hardly any in any other districts actually use any of that language, right? They didn't in 2022, they didn't in 2024, and they're not going to do it in 2026. That's a fact. But do they need to go farther than just not talk about them and actually call these things out? There's not very clear evidence that that's the case. There are some candidates in districts, you know, that are very competitive districts where they have done that. And, you know, they won, but it's such a small group that it's unclear to me, honestly, if you you obviously shouldn't talk about those things, but do you need to go after them? Unclear. I think we should let candidates decide that for themselves in their own districts. But one thing that Roy or people like him need to also recognize is that you can't just move in a more working class friendly cultural direction. You also really have to put economic populism in a meaningful way forward. You can't just have one without the other. So I know that's not a satisfying answer, but I really do think that the jury's still out.
Okay, 20 seconds. Who are three Democratic candidates that embody what you're talking about here? Working class populism.
Gabe Vasquez, New Mexico. Dan Osborne in Nebraska, and I would say Nathan Sage, candidate for Senate in Iowa. Those are three great
right
examples
here in Iowa. Great. Okay. Very good. Well, this has been really interesting. Jared Abbott, the director of the Center for Working Class Politics, has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. I'm going to have you back on because there's a lot more questions I have, but we got the audience, I think, interested here. We'll have you back, and thank you again for taking the time today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.